Welcome back. The 5th century BC was the high point of Greek civilization, and a truly amazing number of significant and influential cultural achievements came out of this relatively brief period. In the last lecture, I looked at some of the Greek state's cultural achievements in the categories of sculpture and architecture. In this lecture, I want to continue this theme by looking at Greek theater, and especially tragedy, as well as the second wave of Greek philosophers. If you were to go to a theatrical performance in ancient Athens, you would experience something very different from what we're used to seeing and hearing when we go to a play today. To a modern audience, ancient Greek theater would probably seem very, very strange and alien. To begin with, in ancient Greek tragedy, there was much less acting out of what was going on. Instead, the performers mostly would stand relatively still, and they would recite, or really more accurately, chant their lines. Also, all of the actors would wear large, stylized masks that entirely covered their faces, and all the actors were male. So if you had a female character in a play, it would be portrayed by a male actor. There was also very, very little in the way of props or scenery. Most of the stage would just have been a large empty space. And also, despite the fact that Greek plays are absolutely loaded with dramatic action and very frequent murders, all of that sort of physical action takes place off stage. So in other words, typically a character will come onto the stage and say something like, "Oh, it's horrible, so-and-so was just slaughtered." But you would never, in a Greek play, actually see the murder or even any blood. So, overall, Greek theater is much more formal and stylized in tone. It's not naturalistic acting. Maybe a modern analogy that captures a little bit of the flavor of ancient Greek theater would be the kabuki theater of Japan, which is similarly stylized. An important feature of ancient Greek theater was a group of actors who were called the chorus. Their number would vary, sometimes 12, up to 15, and they would all be dressed the same, and they would sing lines which served as a kind of commentary on what was happening in the play itself. And at the very earliest stage of Greek theater, it seems that you would simply have one actor and a chorus. So the actor would chant a line, and then the chorus would make some kind of comment or a reaction to that. And really, the key moment in the development of Greek theater came when they introduced a second actor on stage. And now, once you have two actors, it makes possible actual dialogue between them, as well as still having the chorus. And so it's really at that point that true theater is born. And eventually, the Greeks add a third speaking role on stage. But in classical Greek theater, there's never more than three of these speaking roles on stage at the same time. One of the biggest differences between Greek theater and modern is that the Greek plays are almost always performed as part of a religious festival. So in other words, staging and attending these plays was actually seen as a form of honoring the gods. So going to the theater in ancient Athens had a religious component that would be entirely lacking, let's say, when you attend the theater today. Athens was really the center of all this. And every year, Athens would put on a state-sponsored religious festival called the Dionysia. It was named after Dionysus, who's the god of wine and theater. And in addition to being a religious festival, and this is very much in keeping with the Greek love of competition, every Dionysia was also a theatrical contest. So each year, they would pick three playwrights who would compete against one another in the Dionysia. Each author would be required to submit a cycle of three tragedic plays, followed by a fourth play, which was called a satyr play. The actual festival of the Dionysia, the main part of it would be the three consecutive days on which these three playwrights would present their offerings. So on the first day, you would sit down and watch three tragic plays from writer number one, and then that would be followed by his Seder play. On the second day of the festival, you would watch four plays by writer number two, and so on. And then at the end of the festival, the playwrights were awarded prizes for first, second, and third place. And it was a major honor if you won first place at the Dionysia. Now, I mentioned these Seder plays. They were not part of the standard tragedic cycle of three plays, but instead these were shorter, kind of comedy performances, and they often featured very crude humor, dancing, singing, even sort of slapstick comedy. And I think maybe these were seen as a necessary comic relief so that the spectators wouldn't go home each day after being excessively depressed by having sat through three tragedies in a row. Fifth century Athenian tragedy is important not just because it represents the beginnings of the Western theatrical tradition, but also these plays functioned as a key form of social criticism. Greek tragedies were usually about mythological characters and situations. They're almost never about real or contemporary people or events. But the genius of Greek theater is that the authors would use these mythological settings to explore contemporary concerns, and often to investigate ethical questions. And in this way, tragedy becomes a mechanism by which the Greeks could question the values of society, and sometimes even as a way to confront their deepest fears. Just as with the Ionian rationalists or the Athenian experiments with democracy, here we can see that willingness of the Greeks to kind of boldly challenge the status quo and to consider completely new ways of thinking about themselves and society. For example, one of the most famous Greek plays is about the Greek hero Agamemnon coming home from the Trojan War. And when he does this, he finds that his wife has been having an affair while he was off fighting. Now, this is a myth, but at the very time when this play was being staged in Athens, many of the men were away from home serving in the Navy. And so no doubt what many of them were worried about was, what is my wife doing back home while I'm overseas? And so this mythological play reflects the very real anxiety of Athenian men at this time. And this is an example of how the topics chosen by these authors could explore subjects that the Athenians themselves may have had a hard time confronting or even admitting to themselves. And often plays would criticize current political leaders or even government policy. Let's look briefly at the three most famous playwrights of Greek tragedy. And for each one of them, I'll give you just one example of their work. Chronologically, the first of these three great authors is Aeschylus. We know that he won first place at the Dionysia an amazing 13 times. So he was a very popular author. He also fought at the Battle of Marathon, and it was actually that action that he was most proud of. So we know that when he asked, when he had his tombstone made, he asked that his service at the Battle of Marathon be what was put on it rather than his accomplishments as a playwright. And he's the one who's often credited with having introduced that additional actor into Greek drama. One famous cycle of his plays is called the Oresteia, the first play of which is the Agamemnon, which I talked about a little bit earlier. Now, a standard recurrent theme in Greek plays is that one bad deed will lead inevitably to another, and you end up with a chain of interrelated disasters. And the overarching plot of the Oresteia very much reflects that theme, since over the course of the three plays, it tells a continuing story. And in the course of the story, we see a father who kills his own daughter, which leads to a wife killing her husband, which leads to the son killing his mother. And really, the question that this cycle poses is, how do you stop this kind of chain of terrible violence once it's begun? Now, despite this rather grim-sounding plot description, the ending of this particular cycle of plays is a positive one. Because as a result of all these tragedies, the first law court gets established at Athens. So, this play or play sequence contains important messages about human nature. It addresses things like the cruelty and the compassion of the gods, as well as finally asserting the importance that human beings establish rules of justice to bring order to society. A kind of amusing bit of trivia about Aeschylus is that supposedly he met a very bizarre death one day while walking along a beach. There was an eagle that habitually hunted turtles at this beach, and the eagle would swoop down, grab the turtles, lift them up in the air, and then drop them on rocks to break them open so it could get at the tasty meat inside. Well, unfortunately, Aeschylus happened to be bald, and allegedly the eagle dropped a turtle on his head, mistaking it for a convenient rock, and thus killing the unfortunate playwright. The second of our great tragedians is Sophocles, and many regard him as the best writer of all. But even though he wrote 123 plays, unfortunately, only 7 of these survive that we can see today. We do know that he won the Dionysia 18 times, and that he never placed worse than 2nd. And maybe the most famous of all his plays is one called the Antigone. The basic plot of this play is fairly simple. A woman, whose name is Antigone, wants to give a proper burial to her recently deceased brother. The catch is that the king has decreed that her brother is a traitor because he had participated in a recent civil war, and so he is denied burial rights. Well, Antigone is torn between what she feels is her duty to her family and the laws of the state. And being a Greek play, not surprisingly, this conflict touches off a whole series of disasters. As luck would have it, Antigone happens to be the fiancée of the king's son, so that when she does bury her brother, and the king then condemns her to death, she hangs herself, which causes the king's son to commit suicide, which causes the king's wife to commit suicide, and on and on. Anyway, everybody dies. By the end of most Greek plays, in fact, pretty much everyone is dead or insane. But these plot details are really less important than the ideas that this play explores. And this play tackles some of the fundamental issues every society, and really every individual, has to struggle with. What is more important, the good of the state as a whole, or the rights of the individual? Does an individual owe a greater allegiance to society or to his or her family? What do you do when your religious beliefs conflict with the laws of the state? So, once again, at the very time when the Athenians themselves are experimenting boldly with how to structure and govern their society through their art, they're also questioning how should we put society together and what kind of values should we hold. Finally, the youngest of the three tragic playwrights is a man named Euripides. And of the three, he's maybe the most dramatic, or we might even say melodramatic. And interestingly, he was also the least popular. He only won the Dionysia 4 times. And one of his favorite themes was that he liked to craft plays in which he explored what happens to people when they're placed in situations of extreme emotional pressure. The example of this is one of his plays called The Medea. And just as with the Antigone, the protagonist of The Medea is a woman. But in this case, she's a foreigner, not a Greek. And even more, Medea is very, very intelligent. And finally, she's also a powerful sorceress. Now, this powerful woman ends up falling in love with a Greek hero named Jason. And for the sake of her deep love for Jason, she ends up sacrificing almost everything in her life. Out of her love for Jason, she abandons her family, she betrays her homeland, she commits murder, she helps Jason rob and loot her own land of its greatest treasure, and she even kills her own brother. So here we have a woman who has given up everything for the man that she loves. Well, after Medea repeatedly saves Jason's life with her magical powers and her intellect, the couple returns to Greece and settles down. And Medea gives birth to two children by Jason. And it's actually at that point that the play begins, with Jason now declaring that he's decided to leave Medea and marry a younger woman who happens to be a Greek princess. Now, Euripides here has created a situation to pose the question, how will Medea, a woman who has given up everything for her love of Jason, react when he spurns that love? Well, being a Greek play, you know the answer is not going to be good. Medea is set on revenge, but she decides it would be too easy just to kill Jason. She wants him to suffer. So she begins by murdering Jason's new bride in a particularly gruesome fashion. In the course of that, she also accidentally kills the girl's father as well. But then, to really, really make Jason suffer, she takes things one more step, and she kills her own children. The play is much more than just an investigation of what might drive a mother to kill her own children. The underlying themes that it's looking at really include a nice expression of Greek men's fear of women, especially powerful, smart women. It also encapsulates Greek paranoia about foreigners in general. And it also even challenges the Greeks' self-image of representing rationality and logical thought. All of these art forms that I've been talking about, sculpture, architecture, theater, flourished in the 5th century BC at Athens, especially in the decades after the Persian Wars. This is the time of the Athenian Empire. And the great leader of Athens, Pericles, he plays a significant role in encouraging these developments. Pericles gives a famous speech in which he refers to Athens as the school of Hellas, meaning that all the rest of Greece looks to the cultural example and model which is set by Athens. A final major area of cultural accomplishment in the 5th century is philosophy. So we've already seen the first and earlier wave of Greek philosophers, the Ionian rationalists. They had concentrated on exploring the natural, physical world. But now there appears a second important group of philosophers with a very different emphasis. And these guys are usually called the Sophists. They're still concerned with asking questions. But the Sophists now narrow their focus down from the natural world more towards the internal world of the human mind. So this still includes some speculation about cosmology, but rather than stressing personal observation, their ideas tend to be based on abstract thought. And so many Sophists shift their interest a little bit more towards things like human behavior, ethics, politics, history, and psychology. When the Sophists were not actively engaged in philosophizing, they would earn a living by teaching what today we would call debate skills, for a fee. They would teach the techniques of how to make verbal arguments to the young people of Athens and to other states. And especially in a place like Athens, where the government encourages citizens to speak out at public assemblies, having these oratorical skills could lead to political power. This sort of teaching, however, also makes them unpopular with certain segments of society, particularly those who are of a more traditionalist, conservative mindset. And those people tend to view the sophists almost as parasites or tricksters, and they see them as posing a threat to society because at times they seem to advocate moral relativity. And those same rhetorical techniques that can be very useful for persuading an audience, you can also view those things as a kind of verbal trickery, or you can see all their complex arguments sometimes as just arguing for argument's sake. The reputation of the sophist isn't helped by the very esoteric nature of many of their arguments. And a nice example of this is a famous work by one of the most famous sophists, a guy named Gorgias. Gorgias wrote a book that demonstrates through lengthy and complex logical arguments that it's really not possible to prove that anything exists. Now, this would be troublesome enough, but then he goes on in a second section of this book to show by lengthy arguments that nothing exists, but if it did exist, we wouldn't be able to understand it or even to properly comprehend it. And finally, he tacks on a third section to the book in which he argues that, well, nothing really exists, and if it did exist, we couldn't understand it, and if by some miracle we could understand it, we would never be able to communicate it. Now, to the average person worried about things like getting in the crops on time, this sort of abstract theorizing seems neither comprehensible nor really very helpful. And so the segment of the population that is most attracted to the sophists tends to be young, idle, rich men who like the idea of challenging their elders. Athens of this time also had one of the greatest thinkers of all history, Socrates. And even though Socrates was often lumped together with the sophists, he never accepted money for his teaching. And in fact, he might have even disputed the notion that he was a teacher. Socrates wrote nothing himself. We know him only through the writings of others, especially Plato. And Socrates viewed himself as being on a divine mission for knowledge. And he's famous for having developed a methodology of inquiry composed entirely of just asking questions. This method is the Socratic method. And what he would do is he would begin by posing a seemingly simple and innocent question to a person who was allegedly wise. And then he would keep asking additional questions. And these further questions would typically challenge the assumptions of his subject or point out contradictions or flaws in his statements. So that eventually the poor victim of Socrates' inquiry would be trapped in a maze of contradictions and ultimately had to admit his own ignorance. And it's a form of instruction that's based not on providing answers, but on forcing other people to reach their own conclusions and to really rethink their own beliefs. It also made him very unpopular with many people who were embarrassed by being subjected to his sort of inquiry. Socrates is a complex person. In addition to being a philosopher, he fought as a hoplite in the Persian Wars. And he was very patriotic. He was proud of having done his civic duty for Athens. And even though at times he disagreed with the law, he always believed in upholding the law. He was also completely unafraid to be unconventional or to go against public opinion. And one story that illustrates both this aspect of Socrates as well as that Greek adoration for the young athletic male body, concerns a dinner party that he once went to. A major part of Athenian social life were these dinner parties. And at them, a common form of entertainment was to watch young men dance naked. Given the Greeks' aesthetic veneration of the male body, this is not surprising. And so in one of these parties, when the dancing boys got up and began their entertainment, Socrates suddenly announces that he too is going to take off his clothing and dance. Now, you have to understand that at this point, Socrates is very old, he's fat, he's wrinkly, he is not a physically attractive person. So this declaration truly horrifies all the other diners. You can imagine that if you're an ancient Greek, the last thing you want to see is an old, fat, ugly Socrates dancing around naked. But Socrates says, no, my actions are perfectly logical because dancing is good exercise, and even the elderly can benefit from exercise. Another rhetorical technique of Socrates was that he liked to use analogies to make his arguments and to help people understand difficult concepts. So this kind of Socratic method of questioning and the frequent use of analogy finds parallels in the way that other intellectuals of this time tried to bring enlightenment to their pupils. And if, for example, we consider some of the Upanishadic texts, which the forest mystics of India used to instruct their disciples, we find exactly the same kind of dialogue that we have for Socrates. For example, in one interaction, there's a student who doubts the existence of the soul because he can't physically see it. And an Upanishad mystic kind of prods him to reconsider this viewpoint through a series of questions and an analogy using a fig. And the dialogue goes like this, and it's very Socratean. So the teacher says, "Divide the fig." "It is divided, sir." "What do you see there?" "Very small seeds, sir." "Of those, please divide one." "It is divided, sir." "What do you see remaining there?" "Now I can see nothing at all, sir." "Verily, but from that tiniest essence which you do not perceive, from this a great fig tree grows." And if we look at the accounts of the Buddha, we find again similar descriptions of Socratic-style teaching. For example, in one passage, Buddha explains to a disciple the concept of the middle path using a musical analogy. He says, "Were you skilled at playing the lute?" "Yes, Lord." "When the strings of the lute were too tight, was it tuneful and fit for playing?" "Certainly not, Lord." "And when they were slack, was the lute tuneful and fit for playing?" "No, Lord." "But when the strings were neither too tight nor too slack, was your lute tuneful and fit for playing?" "Yes, Lord." "Even so, thus it is with the middle path that I propose." Before ending this lecture, let me quickly mention another famous philosopher of this time, and that's Socrates' student, Plato. Very much in contrast to Socrates, Plato wrote a lot, and his works have profoundly influenced the whole subsequent course of Western philosophy. Plato developed a distinctive and influential view of existence itself. In a nutshell, he posited that the world that we can perceive with our senses is not actually reality. He believed there is a second world that can only be reached through pure thought, and that all things exist in that second world in their perfect, ideal, true form. And everything that we sense or perceive in this world are really just pale, imperfect shadows of those ideal forms. And he attempts to explain this idea with a famous analogy called the parable of the cave. In general, Plato's ideas stress order and unity. For example, he has a rather totalitarian image of what he thinks would be the ideal state. And Plato represents a bit of a turn away from the hands-on experimentation and natural science of the Ionian rationalists, and more of a turn towards a form of philosophy that focuses on abstract thought. Well, the last two lectures I've paused to examine some of the important cultural achievements of the Greek Golden Age. In the next lecture, we'll return once more to our historical narrative, and we'll find out how the 5th century BC ends. And it will end in utter disaster for Greece. We'll also return to Socrates and see the shocking manner of his death. Thank you.